It's more than just words on a page, more than ink and paper. It's a universe waiting to be explored, to learn from, to laugh with, to see life through a different lens. Every story leaves its mark, and every reader leaves with a bookmark. Welcome to The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Good afternoon, I'm Batya Bricker, and you are listening to 101.9 Chai FM's Bookmark, the home for stories and the people who love them. Today's show is all about how truth is not just stranger than fiction, but sometimes even more entertaining, more stimulating, more deliciously unbelievable than anything a novelist could dream up. We tend to think of nonfiction as worthy, important, educational, good to read, the literary equivalent of steamed broccoli. But the truth is, some of the most gripping, heart-thumping, wide-eyed narratives you will encounter are shelved under biography or history or memoir. It's real people, real stakes, real consequences, the theatre of real life. What I like about nonfiction is that it invites the reader not just to escape, but also to expand, to see how extraordinary, ordinary people can be, to understand that history is not a dry timeline, but a series of human dramas, and that investigative journalism can read like a thriller, science can be a love story, even statistics in the right hands can move you. And because we live in a country that offers enough fodder for fiction, yes, but certainly nonfiction too, I have today four real South African stories that I promise will captivate, astonish, and entertain. Are you a reader of nonfiction? I'd love to hear. Have you recently read a book that was both true and engrossing? Let me know on the SMS line 061-895-1019. The first book I want to delve into is The Deal by Mandy Wiener. Let's rewind to the 29th of May, 2024. It's election night. And for the first time in 30 years of democracy, the ANC did not secure a majority. You could feel it, that collective national intake of breath. What now? There were just 14 days constitutionally mandated to elect a president. 14 days to negotiate the future of the country, 14 days of market jitters, of currency swings, of social media frenzy, and very real political brinkmanship. Would the ANC turn left towards a so-called doomsday coalition with the EFF and Patriotic Alliance, or would it pivot center towards its longtime adversary, the DA? What about the smaller parties, and what of Jacob Zuma's MK party? While most of us watched from the outside, refreshing news feeds, speculating on WhatsApp groups, Mandy Wiener was doing what she does best, getting behind the curtain. She says, I decided to write this book because I believe that we, the South African public, have a right to know what goes on behind the political curtain. And what she does is draw that curtain back. She reveals negotiating teams meeting under enormous pressure, deals teetering on collapse, personalities clashing, factions maneuvering, back channels humming. And together with that drama, she adds careful, rigorous, deeply reported journalism with exclusive interviews and context and analysis. Reading The Deal, you realize how close things came to unraveling. And you don't have to be a political junkie to be gripped by this. The Deal is a compelling record of history.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
You are tuned in to Chai FM's Bookmark, and I'm Batya Bricker. We are talking nonfiction, engrossing, captivating, sometimes stranger than real life nonfiction. The book I want to talk about now is called Hope Arising, and it's the story of the South African Julie electric vehicle and why it still matters. It was written by Gerard Swart, and It's an interesting book because you know the feeling when you say, we almost did it. We almost built the thing. We almost changed the game, almost rewrote the narrative of what this country is capable of. And this book is about one of those almosts. But it's also about how if we got so close this round, we can make it all the way next time round and why that still matters. The book is called Hope Arising, and long before electric vehicles were gliding silently through Sandton traffic and long before Tesla became dinner table conversation, at the southern tip of Africa, four engineers had a bold and audacious idea. What if we built a world-class electric car here? Designed, engineered, imagined, and built in South Africa. The result was the Jolie. Sleek, futuristic, proudly South African, and for a while it captured the imagination of the public, the media, investors, even political power corridors. It felt like something big was happening, like we were stepping into the global innovation arena, not as spectators, but as players. And then it ended. In 2012, the project was terminated. Optimal Energy closed its doors, and many were left with questions we never quite got answers to. Gerard Swart, who is the co-founder and lead engineer, tells the full story in Hope Arising. This is an engineer who worked on the Rooivlak attack helicopter, who led systems integrations for parts of the Hong Kong International Airport, who was involved in the Southern African Large Telescope. So he is not an outsider. He was literally in the room, in the labs, in the investor boardrooms. And he tells us about the triumphs, the design breakthroughs, the engineering puzzles, but also the missteps, the systemic challenges, the funding realities, and the brutal complexity of trying to build globally competitive technology within a developing economy. But here's the thing. It's not a bitter book. It's not a blame book. This is a hope book. Swart positions the Jolie not as a failed project, but as a prototype of possibility, a blueprint, a lesson set, a reminder that African industrial excellence is not a fantasy. It's feasible. It requires alignment, long-term thinking, and courageous leadership, but it's possible. For entrepreneurs, for policymakers, for engineers, and frankly, anyone who has ever tried to do or build something big and meaningful in South Africa, this book will resonate. It is not just a car story, it's a nation story. Are you a reader of nonfiction books? Have you recently read a book that was both true and engrossing? I'd love to hear more. Let me know on the SMS line 061-895-1019. My next book is called It's About Time, Banking Beyond Borders by Adrian Saville and Bruce Whitfield. And I must start here with a bit of a confession because I'm not a banking person. Spreadsheets do not thrill me. Interest rate cycles are certainly not my bedtime reading. And yet I was completely gripped by this story. How does a book about a digital bank founded in 2012 by a small team inside Deloitte Consulting become page-turning reading for someone who's not really interested in the numbers? And that's because this book, It's About Time, isn't really about banking. It's about audacity. It's what we would call chutzpah. The story starts in South Africa, a country the IMF once ranked as the hardest place to do business out of 49 surveyed nations. Not Silicon Valley, not Singapore, South Africa. Your mission is financial inclusion. A multi-country bank that actually serves people who've been excluded from the traditional banking system. Within a decade, that vision becomes one of the fastest growing fintechs in the world. And then the roller coaster really begins. One of the world's largest banks acquires the company. There's a massive corporate clash, cultures collide, and 4 years later, divestment. Then a South African billionaire steps in. Then COVID-19 hits. The business nearly collapses. Shareholders insist on grooming a successor of their choosing. There were 217 pitches for fresh capital, and not one lands. 217. I think if this was fiction, an editor would say, tone it down, that's a bit dramatic. And then at the 11th hour, an investor steps up, and then another, and the story continues. What makes It's About Time so compelling is that it's written by two people who understand both the numbers and the narrative. Adrian Saville is a professor of economics, finance, and strategy at Gibbs, and he brings the structural insight. And Bruce Whitfield, yes, the Bruce Whitfield from The Money Show on 702 and Cape Talk, brings the storyteller instinct. The result is a business biography that reads like a thriller. Because what you begin to realize is that time is not simply a bank. It is a case study in resilience and renewal. So the founders had the foresight to partner with a family-owned food retailer to create a low-cost physical banking footprint. That decision alone reshaped access to financial services in this country. It was practical, it was grounded, it was clever. And then they went global. They launched in the Philippines. They rebuilt their banking stack in the cloud. They worked with over 500 Vietnamese developers. And they assembled a team from all over the world. And by June 2025, Time Group was named one of Time Magazine's top 100 most influential companies in the world, from 217 failed pitches to global recognition. It's a must read. We're soon going to be chatting to David Williams about a fascinating new book called The Story of 702. But before that, a word from some sponsors.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
You are tuned into 101.9 Chai FM's Bookmark. I'm Batya Bricker. And this is the show that celebrates books and the people who love them. Today we are joined by David Williams, journalist, broadcaster, and author, and someone who has a front row seat to the story we're about to discuss. A very warm welcome, David.
How's it, Butcher?
Nice to have you on the show. What does it feel like to be on the other side?
Yes. It's funny, but you know, radio is so special, TV isn't, so it's always good to be on radio either side of the microphone.
I couldn't agree more. The story we're going to talk about, it's called The Story of 702. It's a book written about the history and the life of 702, the radio station, in touch, in tune, and independent. And in the final decade of apartheid rule, a feisty new independent station called Radio 702 exploded on the scene in South Africa. It was innovative, in your face, and exciting, and it revolutionized the local broadcasting scene, breaking boundaries and challenging conventions as never before. It became the station that everyone was talking about. And from the outset, it embedded itself in the community it served and engaged with its audiences in so many different ways. And in that process, it became a beacon for much of the country's most promising broadcasting talent, from the legendary John Birks to John Robbie, Jenny Chris Williams, Dan Mayani, and many others. It quite literally changed the game. The book is packed with entertaining anecdotes and nostalgic images from that time. You flip through it and you can't actually believe you can remember. You remember the moments. You will love paging through it as much as reading the text. So David Williams has co-written several books on South African history, sport, and politics. And this, The Story of 702, takes us behind the microphone to tell the remarkable story of how one radio station became woven into the political and social history of South Africa itself. And it was, David, originally, it was called Channel 702, it was called at first, and it did change the face of radio in South Africa. Tell us a little bit about that early start and how it really became the only show in town.
Yeah, and that Butcher, was the title that I originally wanted for the book, which was The Only Show in Town, because there was a period, I think, probably 20 years, 25 years from its inception, certainly 20 years. It was the only show in town in terms of being up to date and keeping people in touch and so on. But I think it's What struck me in talking about it, and now again after some time, because the book's been quite a long process in coming out, so seeing it again and reading some of the stuff again, is people really have to imagine a world where the SABC, its radio stations and three TV stations, were the only media available. The National Party government was at its height. There was no freedom of speech in broadcasting. So it really was a different world. And 702 started through this loophole in the Bantustan, the homeland policy of the government. They established these places like Sitkai and Transkai and Bapute Tswana, which are now archaic names for the archives. But the government wanted them to be independent countries and legally made them independent countries, although no one else recognized them. And 702, like Capital Radio before it in the Transkei, took this opportunity, and Izzy Kirsch, who was one of the visionaries who saw the gap, they exploited this loophole, because an independent country next to you could host a radio station, and there's nothing you could do about it. So, unless the government admitted that its own policy wasn't valid, it had to allow 702 to broadcast from neighboring Bapute Tswana. And in fact, there was a slice of Bapute Tswana just north of Pretoria. So that's where the 70 signal came from. In theory, it was illegal. In practice, it was another country, so to speak, and it reached the lucrative Johannesburg, Pretoria, the Gauteng market. And you said revolutionary and literally changed the way things worked. And I think there are three ways it did. And as we said at the launch the other night at Prime Media, I don't think any other radio station in the world had the impact that 702 had in Johannesburg, Gauteng, Pretoria, and so on. Firstly, in business terms, as a radio station, as a business, it was a phenomenal success in a way that no other radio station in South Africa had ever been. And as you said, it was a magnet for talent. So anyone who was anyone in broadcasting wanted to get to 702. And it then exported a lot of talent to other radio stations later. Secondly, it was a social contributor. It started the helpline in Hillbrow. It started social programs, feeding programs, on a scale never before seen. I mean, you used to have, for example, the old Springbok radio of the SABC. They used to have a Christmas phone-in where you pledged some money for the poor and so on. This was on another level completely. And when 702 star broadcasters would push a particular cause like Operation Hunger, and there was the famous event of the concert in the park where Ellis Park was full and it was multiracial, which was very special for those days. And they generated all this money for Operation Hunger. So it was astonishing in its social contribution. And then thirdly, politically, when the country opened up, Nelson Mandela came out, it was just when 702 became talk radio, and it became the space. SABC wasn't sure what to do with this freedom. They were still under the control of the government. 702 took the gap, interviewed all politicians across the spectrum, encouraged discussion, and I think prepared the way for democracy.
The photographs are as jaw-dropping as the stories in this book. And you just reminded me on page 98, this concert in the park, there is an image of Ellis Park, but packed, and as you say, every shade, color, different people. And the headline said, they came to lend their ears and they left giving 400,000 rand. That was the grand total, which of course was an enormous amount of money at the time.
Enormous.
And Channel 702 really didn't start as talk radio. It started as a music station. One of the stories you've related is about Gary Edwards and I think Hannabury talking over knives and forks and little packets of sweeteners as to a new vision for 702. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I found this so fascinating. Hennebury, Bob Hennebury, was an American consultant who consulted to a lot of American commercial stations. And I think the United States was by far the pioneer of real commercial radio stations and local stations. There are hundreds of local stations all over the United States, maybe thousands. And he used to consult to these, and he knew what worked. And he came and listened to 702 as a consultant, and he said, if you listen to me, I will make you a fortune. I will make you a phenomenon. And I remember when I was doing the news at Sport in the early days at 702, they'd say, Hennebury's here, Hennebury's here. Meaning, you know, he used to go and stay at the Carlton Hotel, and he'd hook up somehow to the medium wave signal through the hotel radio. And he would listen for days. He'd listen to 702, and then he'd give his input. But the story you mentioned is Izzy Kirsch went to the United States, and Gary Edwards was another big player. He was the program manager, very experienced radio man. And they said to Hennebury, tell us how to package this station that we have. We're playing music. We've got some personalities. And the story was, he sat them down at some steakhouse table, and he made a clock with the knives and forks and, as you say, the packets of sweetener and so on. And then every 10 or 8 minutes, he would put a little slot with a teaspoon, and he'd say, that's a 2-minute ad break, what they call a spot break in the radio business. And there will be 4 30-second adverts in that slot. So every 8 minutes or 10 minutes, there was this 2-minute slot, and that was observed. And then the music formula, it was the top 20 or top 40 format where you played the same music over and over again. And what he said was, you must make people look forward to the next song, which they know they will know. And Gary used to say, people know what they like, and they like what they know. And this was the old formula that LM Radio used in the 1950s, which was the model in some ways for 702, and Burks, Gary Edwards and a lot of others had worked at LM Radio in the old days. And the principle there was they had a top 20, and every 3 hours they played the top 20. And the next 3 hours they played it again. So you got all the songs that you knew and liked, and they tweaked it. So every week, I suppose, they would take one song off the list and one song on, put a new song on. And then people would get used to that. So you always felt you were listening to music you knew, although they were subtly introducing music that you didn't know alongside the music you did. And Hennebury told them how to put this into a package, which they did. And there were young disc jockeys. Neil Johnson was one of them. He was there the other night at our launch, and he recalled how he wanted to play South African music. He wanted to play new young artists, and he was just not allowed to. There was a formula that you had to follow. And the other thing that Hennebury said was, you've got to get a morning man, a morning guy who will draw the audience. And you've got to be in profit by 9 o'clock in the morning. The station as a whole must be in profit by 9 o'clock. And once you did that, everything, all the revenue, ad revenue that you got after 9 o'clock was more profit. And Burks, John Burks, the boykey from Clarksdorp, as he used to call himself, he was the morning man. He was the man who turned 702 from a good station to a phenomenon, to the point where there were billboards saying, did you hear what John Burks said this morning? The stories of people getting to work in their cars and then sitting in their cars instead of getting up and going to the office because they wanted to finish the interview that he was doing. And he used to do these fun calls. He'd phone people and pretend to be Ronald Reagan, and they'd fall for it. And I mean, it was such fun alongside the music. Of course, he played things like Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin, which was not allowed? The formula.
No.
No, of course it wasn't. But so some of the disc jockeys said to Hennebury, why is John Burks allowed to play Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra if we have to play the top 40 format from the 1980s? And Hennebury said, in every nursery, there's one kid who's allowed to throw jam at the wall and make a mess. And in your nursery, That kid is John Birks. He can do what he likes.
That was John Birks. Well, John Birks was certainly a phenomenon of a character.
And there was a story about him, just while I think of it.
Yes.
There was another news thing when I was working there. I also worked at Financial Mail, and the Financial Mail guy said to me, "What does John Birks earn?" And I asked him one morning, and he said, "Yeah, I'll tell them." And so we had a poster on the street saying what John Birks earns, because people were so interested. And at that time, it was 10,000 rand a month, which, like the 400,000 at Ellis Park, was a fortune in those days. But the story goes that Izzy, or the management of the station, when they got Birks, because he wasn't there at the beginning, when they got Birks to come on the morning show, they said, "Well, what do we pay him? You know, there's no sort of precedent here for what we pay him, what we must pay him." And Gary Edwards said, "Pay him whatever he wants. Just pay him whatever he wants, because he's the man who's going to generate the revenue for the station." Which I don't know what they did pay him initially, but I think quite frequently he asked for a raise and got it, because he was, as they say in American legal firms, the rainmaker. He's the guy who made the money come in. And it wasn't always like that. And he kind of got older and other people took over the revenue generation, but certainly he put 702 on the map.
Oh, to be a superstar. And
And Butcher, you know, he was very shy.
Oh, really?
You know, he was so confident on the radio, and he was audacious. He could take such risks. And he's talking to, 250,000 people. But put him in a room at a party, he was painfully shy.
Yeah, I think radio, any kind of performance, gives you a persona that you can then take on and wear and become somebody else. Mm. That's perhaps the magic of it. There is so much to talk about, and we're running out of time. But I do want to know, firstly, if there are any moments you will ever forget, and also what you want readers to take from this book. But let's break for a little ad, and then I'll come back to you.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
You are listening to 101.9 High FM's Bookmark, and I'm Batya Bricker, talking to David Williams about a book called The Story of 702, In Touch, In Tune, and Independent. David, you were very much part of the newsroom in those early days of 702, and it sounds like it was both chaotic and pioneering. Are there any moments that you'll never forget? Did you love working in that environment?
It was fantastic, because every morning when you went in, you never knew what was going to happen. You were on edge because you were taking a big risk, and our job was to support Birks. He was the star, and we were there when we were doing news or weather or sport or whatever. We were there to support him. And that took on some amazing moments along the way. I mean, he would do an accent, then he'd get me to do an accent, and we'd have a dialogue. And the one day we did a show from the South Coast with seagulls and waves crashing and so on. And Izzy Kirsch phoned to say, what on earth are you doing down in KZN? What are you doing there? It was such fun. And Stan Katz in the afternoon, and I said the other evening, Butcher, that, and I've believed this for a long time, I've always been a radio nut, you know, I've always enjoyed radio. TV's okay, and I've been on TV, but radio's the magic place. And I couldn't believe that growing up as a radio fan, I ended up with two geniuses of radio in South Africa, Birks and Stan Katz. Very different in personality, but brilliant, brilliant. And Katz also a brilliant executive who oversaw the change from music radio to talk radio, because music radio couldn't survive without an FM signal. That was the essence. But we turned it into a virtue with the FM signal also making it accessible to so many more people. And there were these two guys, Stan Katz, it was so funny and so clever. He prepared everything, whereas Birks prepared nothing and went on instinct. And in their own ways, they were brilliant. And I remember once reading a bulletin in the afternoon. We had these sort of little A5 pieces of paper, three, four or five of them, which was the news bulletin, and we'd come in on the hour and read it. And of course, in those days, there was no internet and so on, so it was literally you type it out. And there I'm reading this bulletin from pieces of paper, and Stan Katz calmly lights it with his cigarette lighter. And in those days, they used to smoke in the studio. And he lit the bulletin. So I'm reading, and as I'm reading, the flames are moving up the page, and I can't finish.
No.
And he didn't help me out of it. This was live radio. So this sort of thing went on all the time. It's fantastic. And I think the great privilege, there were lots of moments which were fun, but on a big picture basis, I felt so good being part of something that was so much a part of people's lives and that had such an impact. And when you said you worked for 702, everyone said, wow, that must be fantastic. And it was.
We heard stories at the launch of how people, someone like Jenny Chris Williams, was prepared to make tea and sweep floors if she could just work for 702. And I think it's because as much as it was fun and there were antics and you were obviously having an absolute ball, 702 was actually part of a changing South Africa, shaping history, and very much part of the conversation. They opened the conversation for ordinary South Africans to have their say.
Yes, and you see, that conversation wouldn't have been possible with the SABC, whose talk stations were national. And I think the great genius of 702 was not to try and be national, but to try and be local. And Stan Katz came up with the term 702 land. And he said, the area, the Gauteng area, I suppose, he said, that's 702 land. And it's almost like 702 named the province after themselves. So there was this great sense of identity between the listeners and the broadcasters, and alongside this community outreach and, as you say, the political developments, it really made a big difference. And I don't know if any other radio station, any other country could have had such an impact.
I agree, and I think that feeling of community, of family, of belonging, of being part of something, that enormous change, that really was spearheaded by Izzy Kirsch. Did you work with Izzy?
Yes. So, and I wanted to, I'm glad you asked that, because I wanted to mention Izzy. And it was a family, you had a sense of family, and partly that came from the Kirsch's background in Swaziland. And Nati Kirsch's daughter, Linda, worked for the station as the social officer. Ilana Surat, who also grew up with Linda in Swaziland. So they all knew each other from their childhoods. But those of us who hadn't grown up with them, we sort of just came in like cousins, you know, and everyone was very warm and affectionate to everyone else. But Izzy was, you know, he was a totally authentic man. And I think people didn't quite realize how, on the one hand, he wanted to run a good business, which he did. But on the other hand, he wanted to make a social contribution. And I don't think people realized at the time how much he wanted to do that. And I think in time it became clear that he did. And he was very proud of that. We used to have station parties at Nati Kirsch's house. And it was just sort of natural. It wasn't forced. It wasn't team building. It was just a party. So there was this sense of family, and Izzy was certainly a big part of that. And he wasn't a hands-on manager in the sense that he interfered with the broadcasting. If John Burke said something particularly upsetting to people, he would get phone calls, or the minister of whatever would phone Izzy, and he'd have to defend the station. But I remember him, nice little family touches. His son, William, who then became head of Prime Media, which sprung out of 702, his son William was at that time playing provincial cricket. And on a Thursday morning or Friday morning, we'd be in the newsroom. And Izzy would pop his head around the door at sort of 11 o'clock and say, "How's Willie doing? How's Willie doing?" Meaning he was batting. Was he making runs? You know? And it was just Izzy being a father in the midst of everything else. And, of course, in those days, the only place you could get cricket, most cricket, was on the radio. There was no social media and bulletins through various platforms. So he knew if he wanted to know how his son was doing, he'd come to the newsroom. There was little touches like that that made him such an authentic human man.
The book, The Story of 702, In Touch, In Tune and Independent, by David Williams and Chris Gibbons and edited by David Sachs, is a remarkable South African story. It's packed with page-turning text and nostalgic pictures you will love, and it's now available in all bookstores. And David, I know you wanted to call the book The Only Show in Town. We obviously debated the title. We had Rebel Radio, etc. But I thought last night or the other night at the launch, we should have said The House That Izzy Built, because perhaps that is the spirit of what 702 is and was. Thank you for joining us, David.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
This is Batya Bricker, and you are listening to Bookmark. Before we wrap up, there is one nonfiction book that I must suggest, and you absolutely must run out now and get it. It's not new, but it's so fantastic. It's called Daisy Demelka, Hiding Amongst Killers in the City of Gold. It was written by Ted Buerta. And it's truly one of the most captivating true stories I have ever read. It's the true crime classic about Daisy Demelka, set in the 1920s and 30s in ragtime Joburg, a city of murder and mayhem and gold. Newspapers in London, Shanghai, and New York ran with the news, even a feature in Vanity Fair about her. And the streets rang out with cruel and macabre ditties about this lady killer. So Ted Buerta takes the reader into the underbelly of Johannesburg at this time, and he traces the fascinating story of the mysterious Daisy Demelka, who was hanged for poisoning her son, and many also believed she poisoned her two husbands for their life insurance money. And in the shadow of ever-growing mine dumps, she went about her business quietly and unnoticed, the most unlikely of killers. Even though people close to her kept dying, no one suspected her, not for 20 years. And when somebody finally spoke up, it led to one of South Africa's most sensational trials. Her story unfolds in tandem with those of colourful Johannesburg characters of the same period, such as the Foster Gang, Herman Charles Bosman, the dashing con man, Baron von Veltheim, and a Bonnie and Clyde-style couple, Dickie Malilou and Gwen Tolpert. Some cross paths with each other, and also other famous writers of the era, such as Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Sarah Gertrude Millen, get a feature. Somebody finally speaks up, and then it becomes this sensational trial. By September 1932, a month before the trial started, the public hostility towards Daisy was getting out of control. And this is from the book. Nasty and macabre ditties could be heard on the street, many of them based on the popular song Daisy Bell. And it said, "Daisy, Daisy, give me arsenic do. I've gone crazy to give all my dough to you. You can then make a marriage when I'm safe in the black carriage, but soon you'll flop through a 6-foot drop of a gallows that's made for you." So even though songs and rhymes wouldn't decide Daisy's fate, her lawyer, Harry Morris, a Jew, knew how important a role public opinion played in any trial. He only had to recall the murderer, Dickie Malilou, whose good looks and reputation had counted for a lot in his acquittal. But Malilou was handsome and dashing, and he had gone on wild and adventurous jaunts around the country. Unlike Malilou, Daisy was nothing on her side. She was unattractive, and because of the crime she was accused of committing, required a unique level of evil. And because of the ever-worsening public sentiment, she chose not to have a jury, but only a judge. And her fate lay in the hands of her lawyer, Harry Morris, and the man who would preside over the hearing, Justice Leopold Greenberg. And despite the early hour, hundreds of people gathered on the lawn and the steps outside the Supreme Court on the first day of what the newspapers called the poison trial. It is an unputdownable story, true story, stranger than fiction, in fact. And quite amazing to read about a lady killer long before we spoke about killers and we watched Netflix series in this regard. I hope you have enjoyed today's episode of Bookmark. Join me next week for a show all about looking inward this time. We're going to chat about self-work books that build and inspire, enlighten and ignite shelf improvement, if you will. These are the books that promise better habits, calmer minds, stronger boundaries, deeper purpose, improved mornings, and occasionally a completely transformed life before breakfast. Well, yeah, not really. But some are trite or superficial, but the self-help genre has its cliches, but it has given us, beneath the noise, thoughtful, rigorous, generous minds trying to help us think more clearly, live more intentionally, and take responsibility for our inner worlds, to ask the right questions, to work on the right things, to notice the right patterns, to build the right tools. So join me next week for Shelf Improvement. Until then, goodbye and happy reading.